Welcome to Your Health, a weekly podcast from the Science Desk here at NPR. I'm Rebecca Davis.
And I'm April Fulton. In this week's show, new proof that men are slower than women. Well, their body clocks are anyway.
And inflammation in the body. Can eating certain foods make a difference?
We'll hear from our health blogger about the top consumer-rated diet.
And a new less-than-pleasant fact about bed bugs. And if you're thinking of getting a tattoo,
think again. Patty Naiman has a story about the inks used in tattoo parlors.
But first, autism. The number of children diagnosed with autism keeps going up. But no one knows if that's because there's more autism or we're just identifying it more than we used to. John Hamilton reports on a study in which researchers set out to find every child with autism in a single community. The results, well, they aren't exactly what everyone expected.
Most efforts to identify children with autism focus on kids in special education classes or those known to have language or learning problems. Roy Richard Grinker of the George Washington University is part of a group who thought this approach might be missing a lot of kids on the autism spectrum.
What we wanted to do was to go beyond that and pick a medium-sized city where we could look at every child.
The city they chose is not in the U.S. It's Goyang in South Korea, not far from Seoul. Grinker says it's an ideal place for this kind of study because the government makes sure every child goes to school. But he says South Korean officials and educators had thought autism was quite rare. The group's five-year study of 55,000 children from 7 to 12 showed otherwise.
We found a prevalence of 2.64%. That is 2.5 times what the estimated prevalence is in the United States.
Grinker says the South Korean study probably produced such a high figure because it screened and then tested a whole lot of kids who seemed to be doing okay.
Two-thirds of the children with autism that we ended up identifying were in mainstream schools, unrecognized, untreated.
The team of Korean and American scientists who carried out the study say the result doesn't mean there's something different about South Korean children. Bennett Leventhal of New York University Medical Center is one of the study's authors.
There's no reason to think that South Korea has more children with autism than any place else in the world. What it really tells us is that if you really go look carefully amongst all children everywhere, you find that things are far more common than you previously expected.
But did Leventhal really think that one in every 38 kids in South Korea was on the spectrum?
No.
Neither did his wife, Youngshin Kim of Yale University. She's the study's first author and was born in South Korea.
I had some expectation that it's going to be a little higher than the previous studies because we are including children from the general population that were understudied in the past. But the extent, that was a surprise to us.
Kim says many of the children were probably missed because they didn't misbehave and they weren't failing academically.
These children could function at a level that was expected to do, even though they were having a lot of difficulties with their peers and social engagement.
Also, Kim says, autism carries a severe stigma in South Korea, so some parents may have ignored telltale behaviors. And she says many were upset to learn that they had a child on the spectrum.
Some of the parents were yelling at us, like, you guys are crazy, my child is okay, and getting really angry about it. Some of the parents were shocked, some are devastated, but some are like, oh my God, now it makes sense. Actually, I'm so happy that actually you told me that because I couldn't make any sense out of my child.
The authors say maybe we shouldn't be surprised that autism is so common. After all, brain disorders like depression and anxiety occur in several percent of the population as well. And Leventhal says the implications of this study are global. He says there are good reasons to identify all kids with autism, even if they aren't failing in school.
They're socially awkward and they have trouble making friends. They get in trouble because their behavior is a little odd. And then when we teach them their skills, they actually can fit in better and succeed better. Is it perfect? No, but it's better than not.
The new study appears in the online edition of the American Journal of Psychiatry. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And now here's the results of another interesting study. This one seems to confirm what some women have long suspected, that their body clocks run quite a bit differently than men's. Richard Knox reports that apparently it is true that women run on a different clock than men, and it's a faster one.
For years, surveys have shown that women more often identify themselves as early birds, and more men call themselves night owls, although there are lots of exceptions. Studies have also found that women report insomnia much more often than men. The new study, done in 157 people, may explain why. At a sleep lab in Boston, volunteers spent up to 8 weeks in a windowless room with no idea what time it was in the outside world. That allowed their inner clocks to drift according to each person's natural circadian rhythm. Jean Duffy of Brigham and Women's Hospital is a study author.
What we found was that the cycle length of the biological clock in women was shorter on average than it was in men, and the average difference was about 6 minutes.
Now she concedes that 6 minutes doesn't sound like much, but imagine you have a watch that runs 6 minutes too fast. If you didn't reset it, you'd get more and more out of sync with the 24-hour cycle that we all have to live by. We all have to set our biological clocks each day, because none of us has an inner clock that's set to exactly 24 hours. If it was, we couldn't adjust to seasonal differences in night and day. What the study found is that men's biological clocks tend to run slower and women's faster. In fact, some women, more than 1 in 3, have inner clocks that run especially fast. They complete a daily cycle in less than 24 hours.
If your cycle length is shorter than 24 hours, you need evening light to keep you synchronized.
And darkness in the morning. That's just the opposite of people whose inner clocks run on a cycle that's longer than 24 hours. They need a daily dose of morning light to reset their biological clocks. Maybe the biggest implication of the study is that there may be millions of women who fight every day against their inner clock to do what they need to do.
I definitely think that that's happening out there.
That's Dr. Charles Zeisler, the study's senior author.
I think many women are chronically sleep-deprived because their work obligations, their taking care of children, helping them with homework, whatever is happening that can only be done in the evening hours, precludes many women from getting to bed early enough to get a full, sound night of sleep.
A lot of women can identify with that. But Zeisler also says many women don't see their early-to-bed, early-to-rise tendency as a problem.
There are many women who really enjoy the fact that they can get up at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. They have peace and quiet. Before the rest of the world wakes up, they can get an extraordinary amount done, and they wouldn't trade it for the world.
In fact, he's married to one, Dr. Teresa Shanahan.
I am a morning person. It is a special time in the day that I enjoy and get up and always have.
Shanahan says she's at her most productive when the rest of her family is still in bed.
It's wonderful when I've accomplished 4 or 5 hours of work and the others are just waking up. Like I've had a good jump on the day.
Her husband likes to stay up late.
I'm definitely an evening type.
So how does it work? An early bird married to a night owl. You might think they don't spend much time together.
But if I'm well rested, I am much easier to communicate with. I have, you know, more energy, have a more positive, I think, outlook.
So she says their time together is more likely to be quality time. Zeisler says when they first got married, he didn't realize they were circadian opposites.
We were so much in love that, you know, we probably didn't even notice the time of day.
But they've worked it out. Their 18th anniversary is later this month. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
By the way, that study was published in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, if you want to look it up.
I'm sure a few of us have heard now about the benefits of diets that supposedly tackle inflammation in the body. Reporter Gretchen Kuda-Crowen sorts out fact from fiction surrounding anti-inflammation diets.
Inflammation is a buzzword in the diet world these days. Alternative medicine guru Andrew Weil recommends an anti-inflammation diet, and diets like the Zone and the Mediterranean diet are also built on the principles of the anti-inflammation theory. Lisa Simperman is a dietitian at University Hospitals in Cleveland.
When you talk about a diet that emphasizes antioxidants or a diet that emphasizes foods that are said to have an anti-inflammatory effect, the diets are going to look very, very similar, and that's because they are.
The idea is that eliminating foods that promote inflammation, like omega-6 fatty acids found in vegetable and corn oils, processed foods and animal fats, and increasing foods rich in antioxidants, phytochemicals, and molecules known to reduce inflammation can improve some health problems and the pain associated with them. But Simperman says it's probably too early to say that these diets really have such healing effects.
We are not at the point yet where we can say that diet directly modifies the inflammatory process. We're just not there yet.
The problem is the majority of studies linking diet and disease are either too small or they look at what people ate over years before they ever got the disease. Simperman says these studies are good for generating ideas, but they don't show cause and effect. And diets that say they do are making claims that are largely overblown.
What they are doing is taking, you know, maybe some smaller study or a study that wasn't as rigorous as we'd like to see, and they're using that as a jumping point for making these claims.
What's still needed is a study that takes two groups of similar people, some eating normally and others eating an anti-inflammatory diet, and compares the changes in their health over time. That's not an easy thing to do, and what's even more difficult to achieve, the entire time neither the doctors nor the patients can know which diet they're on. It's the way most pharmaceutical drugs are evaluated. But what about the people who say they do get better because of a diet? Eric Madison, a rheumatologist at the Mayo Clinic, says some people do have sensitivities to certain foods like wheat gluten or milk proteins that can cause pain and joint swelling and can benefit from eliminating those foods. But those cases are very rare. Instead, he argues that the biggest impact of any diet on arthritis pain has nothing to do with the effects of antioxidants on cells, but with calories.
The most important thing to consider is the effect of having too much of anything in your diet. And by that I mean that a big contributor to worsening of arthritis is body weight.
Madison says some rigorous studies have shown that omega-3 fatty acids and herbs like turmeric work the same way in the body as ibuprofen to reduce inflammation and pain, something roughly equivalent to a typical 200 to 400 milligram dose of the painkiller.
It does vary a little bit from study to study what that effect actually is, but the effects are very modest.
But even if these diets don't deliver miracle cures, they still are healthy diets. Dietitian Lisa Simperman says she'd recommend them to anyone. A healthy diet, weight loss, and modest exercise is likely to make everyone feel better, including those with chronic pain. But Simperman and Madison both warn that a diet is meant to enhance, not replace, medical treatments that have been scientifically proven to work. For NPR News, I'm Gretchen Kuda-Crowen in Cleveland.
So here's another diet story from our blogger, Scott Hensley. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi.
Hey, April.
So you wrote about the best diet out there according to Consumer Reports.
We all want to know what the best diet is.
All right. Without further ado, the best diet, according to Consumer Reports, is Jenny Craig. The folks over there looked at seven different diets, and Jenny Craig was head and shoulders above the others.
So anyway, what is the Jenny Craig diet?
It's a combination of food that you get from them, some side dishes that you make yourself, and counseling, either on the phone or in person, weekly counseling. The details of the food and kind of their diet plans you can see on their website. It's, you know, fairly complicated.
What kind of things did they look at to decide, like, why it was the best diet?
Okay, that's a great question. And the folks at Consumer Reports looked at the nutrition and gave them a score on a 100 scale. And Jenny Craig got an excellent on nutrition and an overall score on a scale of 100 of 85. And the thing that put Jenny Craig over the top was some published data that showed at 2 years that people had a substantial weight loss that they had been able to maintain.
Excellent. Well, there was some question about the results of their study, that it was a Jenny Craig study, right?
Yes, and I asked Consumer Reports about that, and the post includes their response, which basically is that almost all the published research on these diets has been funded by the people who are behind the diets. So you have to take it with a grain of salt, but it has been in peer-reviewed journals, and they felt that that was valid enough and important enough to include in their ratings process. In reviewing the diets, part of what Consumer Reports looked for was published research on the diets, studies on what results they had been able to get.
Okay.
And it turned out that almost all that stuff had funding from the companies behind the diets, as was the case with the Jenny Craig diet.
So they compared each company's own research to the other company's research.
The research was not performed by the company. They did academic studies, but they gave the money. In the case of Jenny Craig, I think it was University of California, San Diego. What the Consumer Reports people said was, it's unfortunate that The research that's out there is primarily paid for by these companies, but it has been peer-reviewed and published in these journals, and we think it's valuable to take into consideration in evaluating the diet plans. Not perfect, but best stuff that's out there.
Okay. Well, I'm sure they'll come up with a different result next year.
For people who are interested, the others in the top three, number two was Slim Fast, and Weight Watchers was number three.
So what is going on in New Mexico? I thought the plague was over like a few centuries ago. I mean, there was, you know, this London thing. What's happening?
Oh, well, before you go, let me just read something because I have a book here called Wicked Bugs. We're about to tell you about the plague, so this is sort of appropriate. This is a great book. It's called Wicked Bugs by Amy Stewart, The Louse That Conquered Napoleon's Army and Other Diabolical Insects. And I keep it at my desk. I kind of love it because it's like a little encyclopedia of all of these deadly bugs. And
sweet.
Yeah. I mean, from, you know, Lyme disease to, yes, the plague is in here. I just want to read you the first graph of the little section on the plague. On an autumn day in 1907, two boys in San Francisco found a dead rat in the cellar. Inspired by their father, an undertaker, they decided to find a coffin for the rat and give it a proper funeral. This occupied them for one happy afternoon, perhaps the last such carefree day of their youth.
Oh, boy.
Yes. So anyway, just so you know, yes, the plague is more recent.
It was a long time ago.
And actually, Scott, you're about to tell us about somebody in New Mexico who's gotten the plague recently, too.
To put your mind at ease, April, it is not a common disease, but it still occurs. It
still
pops up
out
from time to time, yes. In the United States, the first recorded case so far this year happened in New Mexico, and the Department of Health there just released some of the details. It was a man in his 50s, showed up in the ER, feverish, all kinds of pain. And anyway, he was treated and is okay now. But it just underscores that the disease hasn't gone away. And as Rebecca points out in the intro, you know, the problem is that that plague comes from, is transmitted usually by fleas that have bitten an infected animal and then pass that, the bacteria to humans. And so the best way to avoid getting plague is not to hang out with rodents.
Dead animals.
Dead rodents.
Specifically rats, perhaps.
Yeah, rats are the bad ones. But one of the things that I found out when I was working on the Post is that pets can get plague. Mm. And in New Mexico, they even pulled together information on the feline cases of plague in the last few decades and mapped that, and that's part of the blog post. And it turns out over the last few decades there have been several hundred cases of feline plague, and it is possible to get plague directly from a pet if it bites or sneezes on you. So keep your pets away from the rodents that might be carrying those nasty fleas too.
So can you be treated for plague now?
Yes, antibiotics, but you need to catch it early.
You still don't want it.
Still don't want it.
Okay.
Bad disease. Okay.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Scott.
You got it.
Get ready to be grossed out. Consider this statistic. More than a third of American adults under 40 now have tattoos. Lots have more than one. Now, consider this. Inks used in tattoo parlors aren't regulated, and some might not be safe. Patty Naiman begins her report at a tattoo parlor.
At Zulu Tattoo in Los Angeles, co-owner Connie Zulu says design is just one part of the artistry. Color is the other. And at Zulu, there's a dramatic rainbow of choices.
We've got light purple, dark purple, blue, sky blue, mint green, turquoise, lime green, graffiti green, nuclear green, avocado.
Caramel, golden yellow, bright yellow, Georgia peach.
Really any color that you could possibly imagine we can put in your skin.
Safety is a big concern, says Zulu. There are inks that contain metals and plastics. So when it came to choosing a brand, she says Zulu chose the one that seemed most natural.
All of their pigments are vegetable-based, organic pigments, and they are vegan-friendly. Absolutely no animal products used. It's as pretty much as safe as you can get.
But federal health officials are concerned that not all inks are safe and that some tattoo parlors are mixing their inks with other unsafe products. Dermatologist Dr. Tina Alster says that's especially true when it comes to some of the trendier new tattoos.
There are some chemicals that have been shown to be injected along with the tattoo inks to make them brighter or even psychedelic. There are some that actually glow in black light.
And the problem, says Alster, nobody knows for sure what's really in them.
They just find things that can glow in the skin, and they just will inject them the same way as they inject the other inks. It's all put into the same syringe.
And the federal agency that could regulate tattoo ink doesn't. The Food and Drug Administration says they've had more pressing public health issues, and there haven't been that many reported problems with tattoos. FDA chemist Bhakti Pedigari Harp says that may be changing. Recently, the agency's started to see an increase in consumer complaints.
We've seen such things as infections, swelling, cracking, peeling, and blistering at that tattoo site.
FDA researchers have found certain colors, red, yellow, orange, and even white, may be more sensitive to sunlight, more easily broken down under the skin, and more problematic for the body. They found some inks migrated to the lymph nodes. That could damage the body's system of filtering out toxic organisms. Dermatologist Alster says the same is true for ink used in permanent makeup, like tattooed eyeliner, lip liner, and eyebrows.
They often mix different tattoo inks, and a lot of them, we don't even know what's in them. We don't know what the ingredients are. There's some ingredients like cadmium that can be carcinogenic. There are some that cause what we say are granulomas, which is an allergic reaction in the skin.
And there are purely cosmetic concerns as well. Ironically, permanent tattoos intended to enhance facial features often don't age well.
You can have a lip liner tattoo that easily traces a nice full lip when you're younger, but as you get older and your lips thin, the lip liner actually is outside the border of the lip.
And removing permanent makeup, just like removing other tattoos, is more costly and complicated than getting it in the first place. Tattoos are typically removed using a high-speed laser that vaporizes the ink particles.
So that when you hit them with one of these red or infrared short-pulsed lasers, they will form an insoluble pigment. They will get darker rather than lighter. And that's because there are small amounts of iron or titanium oxide in those tattoo inks, and they form this irreversible pigment in the skin.
So think carefully before you get a tattoo. And the FDA says be aware of the risks. If you do have a problem, report it to the FDA website at www.fda.gov. They do have the power to take unsafe brands of ink off the market. Patty Nament, NPR News.
And that's all for Your Health.
Our program is produced with help from Mike Katziff, and thanks to our blogger, Scott Hensley.
You can read all our posts at npr.org/shots.
We'll be back again next week. Thanks for listening.